Hi, this is Mike Behe. I'd like to say hi to everybody at the Insights 2020 Apologetics Conference. And just say I really wish I could be with you, but as you know, these are crazy times. So at least I can talk to you via Zoom. Okay, let me start by sharing my screen. I will talk for about 45 minutes. And hope you enjoy it. My title here is Biological Truth and Myth, Insights from the Foundation of Life. So what is true of what we popularly understand of how life arose and what's open to doubt? Well, in the past 5 years or so, or past several decades or so, I've written a number of things about evolution and the molecular foundation of life. I'm a biochemist, and biochemists study the molecules of life. I've written the three books. The first one is Darwin's Black Box that described the molecular machinery of life and why it's a problem for Darwin's theory of evolution. And I wrote a book in 2007 called The Edge of Evolution. How much can Darwin's mechanism do? And where is the edge of what it can do? What is beyond the edge of evolution? And just last year, I wrote a book called Darwin Devolves. And we'll talk more about that in this lecture. And from those three books, I have two overarching lessons. The first is shown here that Darwin's mechanism is grossly inadequate to explain the molecular structures of life. It doesn't have a prayer, even little things, but we'll talk more about that. The second thing is this, that a firm conclusion of purposeful design is empirically justified. That means we are justified based on the physical evidence to conclude that life was purposely designed. Since I have 45 minutes and this could go on for hours and hours and hours, I'm going to do a brief summary of Darwin's Black Box and skip over the lessons of Edge of Evolution and concentrate more on the new stuff on Darwin Devolves, because I think it puts a cherry on the top of the argument. So let's start with that first one, Darwin's Black Box. So in 1996, I wrote a book explaining why I thought Darwin's theory could not explain what biochemistry has discovered at the molecular foundation of life. And the principal problem for Darwin's theory was recognized by Darwin himself in his book On the Origin of Species in 1859. In one section called The Organs of Extreme Perfection and Complication, Darwin discussed the eye. And even back in those days, it was known that the eye was a very elegant and complicated structure. It had a retina and a lens and muscles and tear ducts and all sorts of stuff. And Darwin gave kind of a maybe the first just-so story about how an eye might arise. But at the end, he admitted that if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. And he added, but I can find out no such case. Nonetheless, perhaps we can help him with this. It turns out that all those steps that he had to consider are at the molecular level of life. The physical basis of life is the molecular and cellular level. So that is the place where one has to look to see how much Darwin's theory can explain. Additionally, this phrase that's highlighted, numerous successive slight modifications, emphasizes that Darwin always insisted that his mechanism of evolution had to work gradually over long periods of time in tiny steps. And he insisted on this because he knew if things improved quickly in large leaps, then it would look suspiciously as if something other than randomness and selection were involved. So let's take Darwin at his word and ask, not if something could not possibly happen, science can't in some logical sense rule anything out. Well, let's ask if there are things in biology that sure don't look like they could be formed by numerous successive slight modifications. And what kind of a system wouldn't be able to do that? Well, in Darwin's Black Box, I invented the phrase irreducible complexity just to capture that concept that some things, such as this ordinary mousetrap pictured here, need a number of components to work. And if any of the components is missing, then it doesn't work half as well. It's broken. So a mousetrap, one you might buy at a hardware store, has a wooden platform and a spring, a tightly wound spring. And the spring has this little hook under it to hold on to another bar, which is actually the hammer, which squashes the mouse. And there's something called the holding bar to keep it stabilized and several other pieces as well. But if you took away the hammer or the spring or the catch or any one of these pieces, the mousetrap would be broken. So this is what I mean by irreducibly complex. Now, if you had to evolve something like this mousetrap through something like a Darwinian mechanism, how would you do so? You can't start with just one piece because that doesn't catch mice. Even two pieces don't catch mice. You pretty much need the whole thing intact before you have any mouse catching abilities. So irreducibly complex systems look like they would be very tough problems for Darwin's theory. So the question becomes, are there irreducibly complex systems in life? And especially at the molecular level of life, because as I said before, that's where the rubber meets the road in biology. That's the foundational level of biology. And it turns out that irreducibly complex systems are all over the place at the foundation of life. And perhaps the most famous one here is the good old bacterial flagellum, which, as I'm sure you know, is an outboard motor that some bacteria can use to swim. And as you can see this from this drawing of a flagellum, which is taken from a biochemistry textbook, the flagellum has a number of parts. It's got this long filamentous thread here that is spun around and around and around and whips against the water, and the whipping motion pushes the bacterium forward so it can swim. And this filament, the propeller, is attached to this yellow drive shaft here by something called the hook region, which acts as a universal joint. And that means that the universal joint means that when the drive shaft is spun around and around and around here, around this axis, that this thing does not spin in the same axis around here, but rather the motion is transferred so that the end just spins round and round and round here. So the spinning motion in this plane is transmitted to spinning motion in this plane, a very elegant mechanism. The drive shaft is attached to the motor, which uses a flow of acid coming from the outside of the cell to the inside that powers the turning of it, kind of like water flowing over a dam can turn a turbine engine. It's got energy in it. And the motor and whole thing is kept in place by something called a stator complex, just like clamps will hold an outboard motor onto a boat in our everyday world. And the drive shaft pokes up through a membrane, and there's rings of proteins that act as bushing materials to allow that to happen. Now, perhaps you can see that the flagellum, like a mousetrap, is irreducibly complex. It needs a number of components to work. If it wasn't for the drive shaft, if it wasn't for the propeller or the hook or the stator or pretty much all of these parts, the flagellum would be broken. It's not like it would spin half as fast as it used to or a quarter as fast. It wouldn't spin at all. What's more, this picture really simplifies the problem, believe it or not, because each one of these pretty geometric shapes is actually a cartoon version of the real pieces. All of these are complex proteins in their own right that have to fit together like a hand in a glove in the right orientation at the right place in order to assemble this machine. So like a mousetrap, it's really, really hard to see how something like this could be put together by numerous successive slight modifications, because the activity, the function of the system as an outboard motor doesn't appear until pretty much the whole thing has been put together. And again, this is not some exception to the rule. One of the great accomplishments of modern biology is to show that the cell is pretty much run completely by molecular machines of complexity similar to this. Okay, so it's a problem for Darwin's theory, but not only that, it's a strong pointer to purposeful, intelligent design. How do we get to that? Is it just because it's a problem for Darwin that we think it's designed? No, that's not right. There's a positive principle through which we conclude design. And it was first expounded by a man named Thomas Reed, who was a Scottish philosopher in the 1700s. And he wrote about the design principle. He said that, you know, we can't see intelligence. We don't, you know, our minds or our heads don't pulsate with light when we're thinking. Rather, he said that the design principle says that intelligence in the cause can be inferred from its marks or signs in the effect. That is, we have to determine if something or someone or some thing is intelligent by looking for the effects of that intelligence in the things that have been done. So we know somebody is intelligent if they do intelligent things that require intelligence. And we know if they're more intelligent, if they can do more intelligent things. Similarly, if we see something that looks like it required intelligence to be constructed, that is the evidence. That's the only thing that points us to the conclusion of intelligent design. So what are these marks or signs in the effect that intelligence makes? Well, let's ask ourselves, what is intelligent design? And if you go to a dictionary, you'll find a number of definitions for design, but here's the pertinent one. Design is the purposeful or inventive arrangement of parts or details. And we can simplify that just down to design is the purposeful arrangement of parts. And that means we infer design, we conclude that design has happened whenever parts appear to have been arranged for a purpose. So that's how we detect design. That's how we decide something was designed. If physical pieces or other things have been placed in a relationship so that they appear to have a purpose, so that they can have a purpose, like the mousetrap, the pieces have been arranged for a purpose. There are a couple other points that we have to take into consideration. We don't have time to go into them today. But one is that the strength of the inference is quantitative. That is, if you have more and more pieces and they are more and more tightly arranged for their purpose, then we can be more and more and more confident of design. A second point that we should always keep in mind is that design can be found at multiple independent levels. So maybe a nut, you can look at a little nut or a bolt or something and say, hey, that looks like it's purposefully arranged. It looks like it's shaped just so and it can fit on this other thing. But then you can find that that has been used to clamp together two other pieces, and those have been assembled into a machine, and the machine is used for a purpose in a larger enterprise. So the point is that design can be found at multiple independent levels. Okay, well, that's a bunch of words. Let's look at an example here. And this is the Far Side, a Far Side cartoon, one of my favorites. And in the cartoon, we've got a bunch of jungle explorers, and the lead explorer has been strung up and skewered. Too bad. And this fellow turns to this guy and says, "That's why I never walk in front." Everybody looking at this cartoon, if you can see it, everyone looking here immediately realizes that this was designed. This is not an accident. It was built on purpose. Well, how do we know that? You know, how do we know it was designed? Well, we know it's designed because we see a number of parts that have been arranged for a purpose. A grisly purpose, but a purpose nonetheless. So we see the purposeful arrangement of parts. Everybody can recognize the design here. As a matter of fact, the artist counts on his audience recognizing this design to get the joke. It wouldn't be real funny if he had just fallen over a cliff. So we recognize design from the purposeful arrangement of parts. And it's important to remember that a purposeful arrangement of parts is the way, the only way that we recognize the work of a mind. Okay, now how does this relate to irreducible complexity? Well, irreducible complexity is kind of a two-for-one concept. That is, it's both an obstacle to Darwin's mechanism of evolution, and it's positive evidence of purposeful design. Because the irreducibility makes it extremely difficult to put this together by numerous successive random steps. And so Darwin's theory looks to be, you know, completely inadequate to explain these. But what's more, the arrangement of the parts in the system is strong evidence of purposeful design. So irreducible complexity is a twofer. Okay, so I wrote about that in 1996. And let me just say, in the 25 years or so since that came out, I have seen no work that has contradicted it or has made me think I was on the wrong track. On the contrary, I've seen much that makes the problem even worse for Darwin. You know, even though you run across blustering essays and so on occasion, it turns out that there is no evidence contradicting that. Now let me turn to the newer stuff. In 2019, I wrote this book, Darwin Devolves, and it takes a completely different tack on this problem than my earlier books did. And the reason it can take a different tack is simply because science has advanced since those earlier books. And with each advance of our understanding of biology, we can see that design extends deeper and deeper and deeper into life. Now, it's a truth about science that it advances with new technology. Our senses are limited. Our eyesight is limited, and other senses are limited. So when we invent new techniques, new machinery, and so on, new equipment to help us investigate nature, then we can see things that were closed off to us before. And a great example of it is Galileo and a telescope. And through the telescope, one could see much further in much greater detail than could be seen with the naked eye. And so our understanding of the universe and all it contains can increase enormously with this equipment. For biology, the big step forward was the invention of the microscope back in the 1600s. And with it, people could see that there was a micro level of life that hadn't been thought of before. Nobody knew that such things as insect compound eyes existed, that insects had tiny little features with great detail on them that helped them in their lives. And so with that advance, we knew that we were living in a much more complex world than before. And it turns out that we are right now living through one of these revolutionary advances in scientific technology that will help us understand how evolution, the scope of Darwin's mechanism of evolution. And the revolution is due to advances in technology to sequence DNA. We learned, it took us till the mid 20th century to learn that DNA is the carrier of genetic instructions. And the genetic information that it carries is in the sequence of the nucleotides that make up the double strand of DNA. Just like the sequence of letters in a book carries information, the sequence of nucleotides in DNA does too. But it's one thing to know that that is the case, and it's another thing to determine the sequence of the nucleotides, and through the genetic code to decode the information. But over decades and decades of work, scientists have been able to develop methods to break down the DNA so that you can determine the sequence of it. And here's an example of the letters A, C, G, and T, which are the part of the DNA alphabet. And with this information, one can determine the exact letters, the exact sequence of the complete DNA, the genome of any organism you want. And with more and more advances in technology, including computer sciences. This has become faster and cheaper and easier over the decades. So that these days, the complete genomes of not only humans, but of, you know, dogs and bears and bees and birds and plants and bacteria and viruses are pretty easy to obtain, or comparatively easy to obtain. And before, just a couple decades before, it was impossible to obtain it. So what have we learned about Darwin's theory from sequencing techniques? Well, let me just say that my book, Darwin Devolves, has three key concepts. The first one is called the first rule of adaptive evolution, and that's what we're going to concentrate on here. The other two are very interesting ideas too, I think, but we'll stick to just the one because of our limited time. So what is the first rule of adaptive evolution? Well, much of the work upon which that conclusion is based was done by this man who is named Richard Lenski, who was a professor at Michigan State University. And back in the 1990, he set up a long-term experiment in which he grew cultures of the laboratory bacterium E. coli, Escherichia coli, in his laboratory. He took 12 flasks and grew bacteria in some nutrient broth in each of them. And the 12 were for replicability's sake, to see if everything is going the same in all 12 flasks. And the next, and because E. coli is so little, it reproduces pretty quickly, so that overnight it can go through 6 or 7 generations. And what's more, because it's so small, in a relatively small flask, you can have 100 million bacteria growing. So Lenski did this. He would grow the flasks overnight. And then he'd come in the next morning and take a small portion from each of the 12 and put them in 12 fresh flasks with more nutrient broth. And again, he'd let them grow overnight, 6 or 7 generations. And he'd come in the next morning and do the same thing, transfer something from each of those to a fresh flask. And the next morning, and the next, and the next, and the next. And he's been going like this for 30 years or so. And in that time, the bacteria in his labs have undergone about 60,000 generations. And there have been a cumulative total of trillions of bugs. And he did this just to see how they would change, how they would evolve. To look at evolution. And this is the best data that we have for what random mutation and natural selection do. And so we should be very grateful to Lenski for the data that he has produced. So let me go back here. In the early days, in the 1990s to the 2000s, he would see that sometimes there would be a change in the bacteria. So maybe that bacteria would be a little larger or some other visible change, visible in the microscope. And he would see those increase in the broth, increase in the population. So he knew that there was a change there, a mutation that was selected. But he couldn't tell what the change in the sequence of the DNA of the E. coli was. He couldn't tell the mutations at the molecular level. And mutations are ultimately changes in the DNA sequence of an organism. But he couldn't do it then because the technology wasn't available, didn't really become available until the 2000s. So he would produce papers saying, look, this was This change happened and it helped the bacteria increase in the population. And look, here's another change that happened, and that helped too. And here's another one, but couldn't tell at the molecular level what it was. Not until about the year 2000. And at that time, technology was advancing, and he was able to show that there was one very helpful mutation that let the bugs grow significantly faster than non-mutant bacteria. But when he tracked it down, he turns out that it was a mutation that destroyed the genes that would allow a bacterium to metabolize the sugar called ribose. And we can't go into the details here, but in all 12 cultures, all of the bacteria lost multiple genes that were involved in making ribose. And that helped. That helped it grow faster. So those things took over the population, and there were no more bacteria left in the population with those genes. So this was kind of the dawn of an interesting recognition that helpful mutations can be ones that degrade or destroy genetic information. And in another paper, he saw that it was not only ribose, but another gene region that helps in the metabolism of a sugar called maltose. He says these changes therefore reflect beneficial mutations, but they were due to deletions, getting rid of genetic information. And getting rid of that information helped. Later on, a few years after that, as technology was getting better and better, he looked at a number of genes that he suspected might be involved in allowing the bacteria to grow faster. These four bars here, A, B, C, and D, are supposed to represent four genes in the E. coli. And he saw that each of these genes in selected bacteria, ones that had a helpful mutation, a mutation in these genes would help the bacteria. But if in one of his 12 replicates, he might see that the mutation was here. But in another one, he might see that the mutation was over there, and another one over here, or over here, or over there. So you ask yourself, why can mutations all over the place help this gene, or help the bacterium be selected? Well, this is the signature of mutations that are working by degrading or destroying the activity of the gene. Because genes are complicated things, it turns out there's a lot of different ways you can break them. Just like if you took a hammer and you hit your computer at a number of different places, there is a great chance you could break it by hitting it at all over the place. On the other hand, if you wanted to improve it, there are many, many fewer places where you can hit it with a hammer. Same thing with genes. So if you see multiple mutations that independently help, then you're likely seeing mutations that are degrading the gene and are helping by destroying genetic information. So not only this one, but each of the genes that he was able to look at that point. Now, this was back in the early 2000s, and I was intrigued by this result, and so I wrote a review of Lenski's work, plus the work of some other folks who were doing experimental evolution with microorganisms. And my review was entitled Experimental Evolution, Loss of Function Mutations, and the First Rule of Adaptive Evolution, quote unquote. And the first rule of adaptive evolution that I developed from reading the results of these experiments was this, that the easiest thing to do in evolution when an organism has to adapt to a change in the environment is to break or blunt any functional coded element, and that's fancy talk for a gene or for a control region, any functional coded element whose loss would yield a net fitness gain. And evolutionary biologists use the term fitness to describe the offspring of an organism. So this essentially just means would yield more offspring. And this is called it's called a rule because it's a rule of thumb. This is not an ironclad law like Newton's laws or something. This is generally what you'd expect evolution to do. And it's the first rule because degradative mutations would be expected to come along first, simply because there are many more ways to break a gene than to improve it. So if by breaking a gene, one could increase the fitness, increase the survival of the progeny of the mutant, then that'll be selected, no matter if it destroyed the gene, and no matter then if it's that gene is no longer available to the organism in the future. And here's an illustration showing why that's the case. Here's points where a gene might be broken. So again, a gene might have 1,000 nucleotides or more, and there's a great chance if you change most of them, any of them, that you're going to mess up the gene. But if you wanted to improve something that was working already, you have much fewer places where you could improve it. So there's a lot, you will get a mutation in a gene that'll break it much faster than you would get it in a gene that would improve it or constructively improve it. People often ask me, how can degrading, breaking a gene, losing genetic information help an organism? Well, there's a number of ways, but here's one illustration. Suppose you owned this really nice car here, really pretty, isn't it? Great. You can, zoom around to impress your friends and so on. But suppose for some reason your life depended on your car getting a somewhat improved gas mileage. Okay? Somewhat improved gas mileage. What's the fastest way you could adapt your car to get better gas mileage? Well, you can get rid of excess weight. You can take off the doors. You can take off the hood or take out the seats and so on. Throw those away. Now, each of those is very useful in many circumstances. But if the situation were such that you would die if you did not get better gas mileage, then this is the way to go. And all your friends who kept their nice cars are no longer with us. So that's nice. This car has adapted to the environment in which gas mileage is the greatest criterion, but it has fewer features, less parts than the previous situation. So the point is that it can be surprisingly helpful to remove something, to degrade it, to throw something away. Okay, here's a paper that Richard Lansky and colleagues published in 2016. And in it, they had two tables. And this first table, they listed the genes where mutations in them helped the bacteria evolve or helped them in their struggle to survive. And if you look at this column, this is the number of mutations that occurred in the gene. And if you notice, all of them have multiple mutations at different places in the gene. And again, this is the signature of mutations that are helping by degrading the gene. And the second table were mutations in genes where the mutations were much larger than changing a single nucleotide. In some of them, large chunks of the gene were left out, deleted. In others, big chunks were included or added to it from somewhere else. And those almost certainly destroy the activity of the gene. So there were a total of about 30 or so genes in tables one and table two. And the take-home lesson for our purposes is that all 30 degraded or destroyed genes. And let me repeat, not only that they degraded and destroyed them, but they helped the organism survive by degrading those genes. And the mutants at the end of this experiment have dozens fewer genes than at the beginning. So here's a conclusion that we can draw. Observation, not theory, not a model, observation demonstrates the following about random mutations. And this we knew for a long time. Of those mutations that affect an organism, about 99% are detrimental. It's easy to break a gene, and almost any mutation will mess up make the organism die more quickly, not as fit as the other non-mutant organisms. We've known this for 80 years or so. Here's the new and interesting part. Of even beneficial mutations, mutations that help, the great majority break genes or degrade function. So I'm going to skip these in the interest of time, but I do recommend you pick up a copy of Darwin Devolves because it'll be explained there. So a summary is this: Darwin's mechanism is dominated by what I call poison pill mutations. And those are positively selected, helpful, beneficial mutations that cause the loss of function of a gene. They break a gene. Therefore, Darwin's mechanism works by squandering genetic information for short-term gain. So just like a spoiled rich kid might take his inheritance and buy this and that and the other thing and have a great time, but each time he spends, he's losing money and he's not bringing it in, and pretty soon he'll be broke. And it's important to realize it's not just bacteria. The first rule of adaptive evolution applies to any organism. And if you look at what has been discovered by DNA sequencing in recent years, you see the principle in action. For example, everybody loves doggies. And for a long time, scientists have been interested in the different varieties, the different breeds of dogs, and specifically from an evolutionary point of view. They say, hey, we have been able to breed dogs that have much different physical characteristics from each other just in the past few hundred years. So in the past 10 or 15 years, when the ability became available, scientists would sequence the complete genomes of different dog breeds and look to see what genes were different, which could help explain their varying characteristics. And here's a table of that. People looked at various characteristics, like whether the fur was black or white or yellow, whether the hair was curly, or whether they had short legs or a short muzzle like a bulldog, or increased muscle mass, and so on. And we don't have time to go through, but the long and the short of it is that the great majority of the mutations are ones that are expected to degrade or destroy genes. Same thing with other organisms that have been looked at. For example, polar bears. Within the past 10 years, the complete genome of the grizzly bear has been sequenced, and the polar bear as well. And it turns out that the polar bear is thought to be descended from the grizzly bear. So scientists wanted to compare the two genomes to see what genes had changed to allow the bear, grizzly bear, to change into a polar bear. And again, of the 17 top mutations, the ones that were most important, a large majority, it says here 50%, but it's actually closer to 75%, were predicted to be functionally damaging. The mutations were predicted to be damaging to the genes in which they occurred. So here's an image I want to leave you with, which really sums up what Darwin's mechanism does in biology. This is a picture I got from the internet, so you know it's true. And it shows a couple of soldiers in South America and a convoy. And it turns out that the up the road here, there was a drug growing operation. And the army was given a tip and that it was occurring, and they were sending forces to shut down the operation and to apprehend the criminals. But the drug growers got wind of the operation, and so they blew up the bridge of the only road that led to their compound. Now, from the point of view of the drug growers, this is a beneficial change. It's helpful. Now they can live another day. They can maybe flee and set up their operation somewhere else. Nonetheless, even though this is a beneficial change, blowing up a bridge does not tell you how bridges are built in the first place. Blowing up a bridge is not the inverse of constructing a bridge. Turns out that this is how Darwinian evolution works, sometimes quite literally. For example, in the case of some parasites like the organism that causes malaria, they invade a cell through proteins on the surface of the cell. They attach to them, use them as a bridge to get inside the cell. But some folks have a mutation which blows up the bridge, gets rid of the protein so that it's no longer there, and then the malaria can't get in. They have lost the services of that protein, but presumably that's more beneficial to them because they no longer get malaria than just the activity of the protein. So in summary, it's only in the past decade or two that science has advanced sufficiently to test the claims of Darwin's mechanism at the molecular level, which is the proper level at which they have to be tested. They're molecular events, and life is run by molecular machinery. And we see that Darwinian processes do work, and sometimes they help, and they have can have medical consequences and other things. But they're pretty much limited to tinkering with pre-existing machinery or destroying the pre-existing machinery. And again, that's interesting and important, but it does not tell us where the machinery came from in the first place. Okay, and now let me just say that I'm running out of time, so I'm going to skip ahead and say, the book has been published, and surprisingly, there are some scientists who disagree with me. I know it's hard to believe, but some do. And there have been a lot of criticisms, and I have responded to the criticisms. And so for folks who want to get into the nitty-gritty of the details of all of this back and forth, you can look for my responses at a number of different places. First, my faculty website at Lehigh University. I have some scholarly papers and things up there. Another good place is at the Discovery Institute's website. Just do a search on my name and you'll see a number of essays that I have written. And finally, I've got my own website these days, michaelbehe.com, and it collects a lot of my replies to the critical articles, and the critical articles are themselves easy to track down. So you'll be able to judge the back and the forth for yourself. Okay, so again, thank you very much for your attention. It's been a delight to be able to speak with you, and I wish I could be with you in person, but sometime I'm sure I will. So my best wishes for a very successful conference, and with the folks you have, Steve Meyer and John Lennox and so on, I'm sure you'll have a grand time and learn a lot. Good night.